They may be all powerful, but when you really stop and think about the Greek and Roman gods clashing, fighting, and exiling from on high, aren't they just members of a giant dysfunctional family? That's what occurred to author Stacey Swan, and that remarkable concept is what led her to write her debut novel. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Olympus, Texas is the book, named for the fictional small town where it's set. We meet the family at the center of the action after the youngest son returns home following an explosive exit from Olympus more than 2 years before. Stacey Swan joins us to talk about her novel and its heavenly parallels. Stacey, welcome to Think.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So you actually had the idea for this mythological through line before you even developed any of the characters in Olympus, Texas. How did you come up with that?
I did. Yeah, I was just one day I was driving because I often get good ideas for my writing when I'm driving. And I was thinking about the way that there's Greek mythology with these larger than life characters, but there's also Texas mythology. Like the state feels very steeped in this idea that everything is bigger in Texas. And all of the characters that, you know, the big Texas historical figures we know, they're also larger than life. And it occurred to me that those two things would mesh really well together, that I could take this larger than life Greek mythology, but just adapt it into modern day rural Texans and have a lot of fun with that.
So Olympus is rural, but it's also kind of close enough to Houston that driving there isn't out of the question, right?
Yes, it's loosely based, at least geographically, on where I grew up, which is about 45 minutes west of Houston.
And you have some really lovely details in the book about the origin of the town and all the things that kind of befell Olympus before Houston was even founded. What were those early challenges that kind of made Olympus a forever small town?
You know, and I actually really used a lot from Texas history there. So where I grew up was out in the country, but the closest small community was San Felipe, or San Philip, as Texans always are butchering the pronunciation of words. And it was that where the original Stephen F. Austin colony was in real life. So in looking up that history and reading more about it, I discovered that, you know, before Houston was even existed, they had established this thriving town. And then at a certain point, it got burned to the ground during the pre-Texas Revolution. And then later, I believe it was in 1899, a flood came that just wiped out every structure there along the Brazos River. And in looking at that, it just seemed things to kind of add to this small town, which you see a lot of in Texas, that they were towns that used to be larger. But just as the economy changed and where railroads went in or didn't go in, some towns shrank where other towns grew.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring that up because even in the bigger cities in Texas, you know, the placement of a highway could decide whether a neighborhood is a have or a have not.
Exactly, right? Yeah, if you're bypassed off the main through line of travel, the economy is just not going to grow in the same way.
So as far as the book goes, what is Olympus like today? Who lives there?
So Olympus would be, you know, kind of a typical rural community. So you're going to have representation from kind of every class group. You're going to have the Briscoes, who are the family that I write about in the novel, would be more on the upper end of the economy. Peter Briscoe, the patriarch, is a real estate agent, and it's mentioned that he owns, you know, a lot of the rental property in town. But it also, you know, includes all sorts of people. It's a community that continues and in the past had farming and ranching, no really large industry there, no factory there. So a lot of people with jobs that are related to the land in some way.
And Olympus has a lot of that kind of small town magic, or maybe you would call it a curse, depends on how you take it, of everyone knowing everyone else and everyone really understanding kind of the economic and social hierarchy as well.
Yeah, it's one of the, you know, growing up in the small town. So where I went to high school was Sealy, Texas. And when I was in high school, there was about 3,000 people in the town. My graduating class was 98 people. You couldn't go to the Walmart in town without running into, you know, five different people that you knew. So I was really aware of those dynamics of like, there is no such thing as anonymity in a small town. And so it's really hard to do anything without the whole town knowing, you know, within the span of a few days, perhaps. And I think when I was a kid, that felt a little claustrophobic. But as an adult, I look back on it more fondly. Like the sense of community that you have makes the whole town almost feel like extended family. And I think it's why I've always loved novels about small towns, like the novels of Richard Russo, and TV shows about small towns, like Northern Exposure and Schitt's Creek. It's just a real sense of community there.
So let's talk about the Briscoe family. The first person we really meet in the book is June. And if we're tracking mythology parallels as we go, she'd be Juno or Hera, right?
Yes, exactly.
So June is a really interesting person. And before you tell me too much about her character, will you please describe that little scene at the beginning of the book where she's sitting outside on the second story balcony with her coffee and what she decides to do with it?
So her and her husband Peter, so June's 55, her husband's 60, so their kids are fully grown by now. They've had a long marriage with a lot of rough patches and a lot of infidelities from Peter in it. So they've kind of settled into a stable marriage, but one in which June has a lot of anger over what's happened in the past. And I was also kind of riffing off of Hera, who also had a lot of anger in Greek mythology for Zeus. So she just lashes out sometimes. So we kind of join them in the morning, and they have a pattern where she gets her coffee, she gets up first, and she goes up on a balcony on the second floor of their house. Peter gets up after her, and he goes and sits on the front porch, which is directly underneath the balcony. So they can talk to each other, even though they don't feel like they're in the same space. And there's a point in the novel where he says something, and she leans over and tips part of her coffee out that runs through the slats of the balcony and hits him below. That she always knows where he is, even if she doesn't want to know where he is.
And I mean, that's such a like an amazing, I wouldn't even really say that's passive aggressive. That's aggressive aggressive. But what's so funny about it is he doesn't even react that much, which means that this must be something that June kind of regularly laces into their interactions as these little moments of rebellion.
Yeah, I think when you're, you know, living with a lot of anger, you get the smallest kind of opening, and it's gonna seep out without you even consciously planning to let it seep out.
So Peter really is kind of the source of her anger. And I heard a different interview that you gave where you talked a little bit about how when you look at mythology, a lot of stuff came onto Hera and Juno, and she was, you know, judged or put upon for her anger, her transgressions, where Zeus slash Jupiter was kind of standing off to the side, just as, you know, flawed and just as embroiled in conflict, but no one was really looking that direction.
Yeah, and it's so funny. It's like you're just raised with these stories and you accept them. And you know, hopefully that's changing a bit now, you know, as things progress. But I remember as a kid, you just accept, well, Zeus is Zeus, and this is what he does. And what he does is have a lot of affairs with people that aren't his wife. And because it's his character, you know, you're not encouraged to judge him for that behavior. But I remember as a child reading about Hera and judging her and thinking like, oh, she's, you know, so angry and so vindictive, and she's taking her anger out on people who don't deserve it. You know, the women that Zeus has an affair with, who often are not exactly willing participants of that affair. So she just seems like someone, you know, that would never be your favorite character. And I really like the idea of stepping back and looking at that with a larger lens and thinking like, well, she's got a real reason to be angry. And so looking at her from that sympathetic angle and letting the reader kind of explore what it would be like to be in that kind of marriage and not want to leave it because you truly love your husband, but also not know what to do with your disappointment at him.
And you mentioned Peter's serial infidelity, and we're not talking about a couple moments here and there. Peter has a group of children kind of dispersed across the city, and June is only the mom of three. Explain to me how her relationship with Peter, June's, and her relationship with Peter also strains her relationship with her son, March.
So we learn in the book that Peter had, so he had a one affair that led to a child, which was right around the time that Peter and June got married. So technically the affair took place before they were married, but June was having her first child around the same time that this other woman was having a child by Peter. So she already has this anger but she moves forward and she forgives him enough to stay in the marriage. And so we move forward several years, I think 5 or 6. And Peter has had another affair, and it has resulted in twins. And the characters in the book are Arlo and Artie. And she becomes so angry and also angry at herself for staying in a marriage that now has 3 children, you know, by her husband that are not her children. And so it's a very difficult pregnancy for her. And then when she gives birth, there are ways that the baby and then later child reminds her of her husband. He is, because she found out about the affair and the other children that were coming while she was pregnant, he's completely tied to this event that she has such negative feelings about. And so it also colors her relationship with March. But you at beyond that, March has his own issues. So when we catch up in the present day story of these characters, when the kids are now adults, March has a kind of rage disorder called intermittent explosive disorder, which has caused him to do a lot of things that have caused pain in his life and pain in the lives of the people around him. And then he's also the reason why he left town is because he was caught having an affair with his brother's wife. And so that infidelity is another thing that hits his mother, you know, directly in her weakest, most tender place. And she can't overcome that anger at her son for doing what her husband had done to her.
So tell me about Hap's mythological parallel, because this one to me was particularly interesting.
Yeah, I feel like Hephaestus or Vulcan in the Roman mythology is a little less talked about as a Greek god. We know a little bit less about him. So he was the god that was like the metal worker. He was always making things, but he was the son of Hera. And he also was slightly lame. So he had a physical issue with his legs. And he marries in Greek mythology the goddess that's considered the most beautiful, Aphrodite or Venus, and they have a marriage. And in Greek mythology, there's an actual myth about how Aphrodite has an affair with Ares, which would be Hephaestus' brother. And that was one of the myths that I riffed off of in the novel itself. So in general, I think of the novel as being more like taking the Roman gods and goddesses and transforming them into characters and just watching the characters and what they do. But there are 2 or 3 scenes in the novel that are kind of direct lifting of Greek myths that I've tried to adapt and make believable for a real world event.
Well, what's really interesting about it too is if you ever go and just research the Greek and Roman gods, some of them have really clear distinctions. You know, Ares is the god of war, but then when you get to someone like Vulcan or Hephaestus, and there's all these different kind of things that they're the god of. You know, it includes like fire and metalworking, but also the art of sculpture. So I loved in the book how you had Hap not just be someone who was like a mechanic who owned a shop, but he was also quite a beautiful artist.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun with that. And I really, sometimes I feel like we see that less often in, you know, depictions of artists in books and in movies. But what we see a lot in real life, you know, a lot of the friends I know, people often have to have another job besides their art. And often they're not making a living off their art, but they're still enjoying doing that art. And so I love being able to explore that you could have this man who was from rural Texas, but he loved art and he loved making things and he went to art school. But then he got out of art school and he needed to make money. So he started an auto body repair shop because he was a really good welder, because that was involved in his sculpture. And that he continued to do both things and not just identify as an artist, which again, I feel like that's super common in real life, but less common in the works we consume.
So Hap and his wife, Vera, are not in a good place. And they're kind of an unusual match in the first place, right?
Absolutely. The whole town is a little confused how Hap wound up with such a beautiful wife. And she comes from outside of town. She's originally from Lubbock, and she meets Hap when Hap is in college in Houston, and she's tending bar at Houston, and they fall in love, her somewhat unwillingly and surprised at herself even for falling in love with him, but they are in love, and the marriage sours for a variety of reasons. She winds up having the affair with March almost as a way to kind of extricate herself from a marriage that she can't bring herself to leave. But after March leaves town, and all this happens kind of, you know, before the beginning of the novel, she comes back, they have an attempt to reconcile, and she gets pregnant with what is their first child and their only child in the novel. And that complicates things and makes her willing to give her marriage another shot. But it's still in pretty rocky conditions when March shows back up in town 2 years later.
And I was going to save discussing this for later in our conversation, but I think it's really interesting to note here, since we're talking about the pair of them, that so this book switches narrators from chapter to chapter, and you get a really different picture of Vera when someone else is talking about her. And then when she narrates, it feels completely changed. And I really almost enjoyed her point of view the most in the book. That must have been tricky to get right.
Yeah, and you know, those parts actually came later in my writing process. So originally I had not planned to use Vera as a point of view because I already had so many different points of view. We've got so many siblings and half siblings and then Peter and June themselves. I like novels that have a lot of different point of views, but I feel like there's a limit. And if you start getting into too many, you run the risk of your reader identifying less with all of them because you're not with any one of them for a really long amount of time. So for a long time, Vera didn't have any point of view chapters. But the more I wrote her, the more she moved from being someone who was just primarily known as, you know, even for me as the writer, she was very beautiful. And she was also pretty mean, and those were her defining character traits. But the more that I explored her and the more I tried to figure out why she would have cheated on her husband in this kind of horrific way with his own brother, the more she became really human to me. And I realized I needed her point of view in these chapters that take place in the past. So they're the chapters that are prior to that week of present day action that the novel takes place in. And they really, they're, you know, I love hearing that they're some of your favorite ones because they're some of my favorites too, that there's something, she was the character I was kind of least interested in writing at the beginning of the book. And by the end of the book, she was the most fun character to write.
Yeah, I probably would have had the same experience reading her because, you know, you think you know who she is based on, you know, how she enters into the conflict in this family. But she ends up being the one who really exposes some fascinating truths about who each character really is.
Yeah, and I think part of that is like the joy of being the outsider. And I think anybody like with in-laws kind of understands that feeling of like when you're in a family and you've had so much history together and you are participating in all of those memories, you don't have a really clear-eyed objective view of anyone. But if someone new comes into the family and gets that really close observation, they can kind of see things differently than you do. And I also think that Vera is just the type of character that she understands people's motives and she can see motives that are not necessarily spoken aloud, and it allows her an even kind of sharper insight to the family, but she's also not very sympathetic to them in a lot of ways. So it's got a hard edge, but it's also really fun to write.
So we haven't talked a lot yet about a pretty important set of twins in the book, Artie and Arlo, and that's a set of girl-boy fraternal twins. And as you mentioned earlier, they came from outside of Peter's marriage to June. So they belong to him, but not her. But they are very much siblings of Hap and March and Thea, as we get to know.
Yeah, and I think it's that interesting thing of, you know, you can think of scenarios where in that space where a husband has an affair or a wife, or I guess it would have to be a husband, but a husband has an affair and the children are completely outside of that family, that it's really easy to keep a border where one family never interacts with the other family and might not even know of their existence. But when you're in a small town and you happen to be the same age, so March is born, you know, in the same calendar year that Artie and Arlo were born, you're going to be in the same school system. And that school system is so small that there's no way that you won't run into each other. And also, there's just no way you can go about your life in the town and not occasionally run into these people. I think it changes the dynamics for June and how she approaches these kids that want to have a relationship with their father, unlike the first child outside of the marriage. And so she lets them in. And so they are both siblings, but also friends to Vera's three children.
And that was actually a little bit refreshing for me to read, because you kind of anticipate some sort of attention, you know, the siblings that are outside, the siblings that are inside. But really, that group of young adults in present day, they really do care for each other and lean on each other and kind of seamlessly blend in a way that you almost kind of forget how they so differently originated.
Exactly. And there's even some amount of resentment on March's part, even though he loves Arlo and Artie and they are his closest friends. But even he notices that his own mother seems to prefer Artie than to him, just because Artie's, you know, easier in some ways. But also, I think Artie's a girl. And so he doesn't hold it against Artie, but he kind of recognizes that this is not the normal way the world works.
Right. So Artie seems very drawn to Olympus and very connected to that town. Arlo seems to want to leave it in his rear view as quick as possible. Why do you think they have such different points of view about where they're from?
You know, I think this is actually something I hadn't thought directly about, I don't think, but I suspect, thinking about it, that it has to do with, like, the things they want to do in the world. So Artie, you know, she loves hunting. She loves being out in the world. She goes to college, but her degree is in animal husbandry. So the setting of Olympus would be a place where she could do the things that she loved. But I think Arlo is someone that I probably empathized with, you know, growing up as a small kid in a rural town and really loving books and wanting to be a writer. You look around and you don't see any other writers, you know, you don't know of any in your day-to-day life. So it seems like a thing, like, if you're going to do it, you almost have to go to the big city, because all the books you're reading, you know, the characters are in New York City, or maybe they're even in Europe. And so I think I sympathize with Arlo for that. So as a musician, he just looks at his hometown as a place that's not going to have a lot of opportunities for him. But I also think part of it's the personality type, and that Arlo, who's kind of based off of Apollo, he's not a person that wants other people in his business. He's not a person, he loves the people that he loves, but he has no desire for, like, a wide community. No kind of desire for a close-knit community, which probably kind of stems partly from, you know, his strained relationship with his father and everyone in town knowing his business, even though he doesn't want them to know it, which, now that I think about it, is something he shares with the oldest sister, Thea. So it's just a place that doesn't feel like a good fit for him. And yet the person he's closest to in the world is his sister, and he wants to be in the same place as his sister, but he's not really happy where his sister wants to be either.
So Artie is such a wonderful character in my view, because I feel like we don't get to read about women very often who are tough and adept at things outside, but who are also so content and open and warm-hearted. I feel like you get one or the other. You either get kind of a bubbly, open, young adult woman, or you get someone who is tough as nails and closed off. But Artie somehow gets to be both.
You know, that's so true. I hadn't really thought about that before either. You know, and I think part of it is, like, when you're growing up in small communities, at least when I was a kid, which was, you know, back in the 1980s, and I probably even today, like, gender roles seem even more fully formed in small communities than in cities, just in terms of the types of jobs people take and how they correlate to the gender. So, you know, if you're a girl, you're steered towards teaching or maybe nursing, and, you know, not towards being, say, like, a police officer. And so in real life, if you're a woman drawn to those things, you almost, in prior generations at least, had to almost make yourself one of the boys to fit into those boys' club systems within these communities that are largely male. And maybe you would even be more drawn to those if that was your natural personality type, to be maybe tougher and less open-hearted and less friendly. So it's funny. I just always conceived of Artie as that kind of character. And she runs into some trouble. There's even a point in the novel where she's talking to the sheriff And the sheriff in the novel also happens to be a woman, and she feels a real affinity for her because here is actually someone who understands how difficult it is to move in men's spaces and be taken seriously without doing a whole lot of work to win them over.
So we already spoke about how there are many different points of view within the book, so you get to hear from a lot of people and really get their perspective and hear their voice. But the format is also interesting in that this book is really short chapters, and it's kind of divided into sections, one for each day of a very long, very weighty week in these characters' lives. Was that intentional to build both tension and momentum?
You know, it wasn't something that occurred to me right away. I think it occurred to me when I was like maybe two-thirds of the way through the first draft. And it took me a really long time to write the first draft. So, you know, that was years into the process by that point. And I just started looking at, like, I'd had a professor in grad school who talked a lot about every story, every novel needs a clock. The reader needs to kind of have a sense of how much time is going to be covered. And when I was looking at my draft, I started realizing that I wasn't exactly sure where in time, like, did scenes happen 2 days apart from each other or 3 days or a week? And so I started looking at the different plot lines and knowing that the more I could compress the time, the shorter amount of time that the novel would take place on, the better the pacing would feel for the reader and the better they would just feel kind of grounded in the world. And in looking at it, I was very pleased to discover that I could actually get all the things to happen in a single week. And then that made it even easier to finish the novel once I had that calendar in my head to refer to. And then the other thing it allowed me to do is I have chapters that are backstory on the family, like origin stories of how things got the way they got. And I felt, you know, you always worry a little bit about backstory. You don't want to slow down the momentum of your story by dwelling too long on the past. But because I had fit it into a single week, I felt like it allowed me to have these kind of standalone chapters that moved us backwards in time, gave us explanations for how the family kind of got in their current straits, but didn't bog down the pacing too much.
Because the backstory chapters are just a few pages. And it's interesting, you know, because they almost feel like when you get to a backstory chapter, it feels like a little piece of a puzzle that you were looking for and that you were given. I noticed specifically, like, this is early on, but when you kind of describe the origin of March's rages, this is very early in the book. We're not giving much away. We already talked about kind of his diagnosis for intermittent rage. And this backstory, he's 4 years old, and it really does feel you're kind of snapping a little corner piece of the puzzle in.
Yeah, it was really fun. I'm so glad you had that experience because it was definitely what I was thinking. Like, as I was revising the book, I would step back and I have this list of origin stories, and I was like, where is the best place to put each of the stories? And so what I was hoping I was doing was, when you hit that origin story, it would either, you know, be that puzzle piece so you understood something that you hadn't been able to fully understand before, like it answered a question that you had that you were waiting for an answer to, or that it upended your expectations, that you thought one thing about a character and then you read that origin story and it made you think a different way. I think maybe Vera's origin stories function that way.
Exactly.
Yeah, and so they're really fun. And then with that particular origin story with March, again, I was always thinking about how do we let characters connect to this person who, on the face of it, his facts is going to be really hard to empathize with. And kind of showing how this started when he was a child and literally had no control over it might also help both give the reader empathy for him and then also empathy for June and how difficult it would be to parent that child.
So you kind of tackled the dysfunctional family in this book. That is something that has been wonderful, hearty source of nutrition for authors across time. What are some of your favorite dysfunctional family books that you've read?
Oh, I love stories about dysfunctional families. And it's funny, I realized, you know, there's a lot of arguments in my book. And one of my favorite things that I read in high school was Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which is like the ultimate dysfunctional couple. There's no kids, but they are super dysfunctional. And I think a lot of my love of conflict scenes comes from seeing that play. I also love Pride and Prejudice, which, you know, we often think of as this kind of social manners romance, but the Bennet family is incredibly dysfunctional. Even Mr. Bennet that we like is contributing to his family's dysfunction. And so that's one I really love. And another is The Lonely Polygamist by Brady Udall. I read that novel as I was writing Olympus, Texas, and it's also multiple point of view. Your kind of main protagonist is a member of a polygamous sect, so he has multiple wives and a lot of children. So we get his point of view and a wife's point of view and one of his kids' point of view. And I think it's just a really beautiful novel. And I know that there's more. The Angela Flournoy's The Turner House is a more recent one that I really love, which is a family in Detroit and their 13 kids.
Ooh, 13. So I want to go back to Pride and Prejudice because I had a feeling you might bring this up. And I think something that I really noticed in your novel is that each sibling that we get to know is very fleshed out, very distinct. Even Thea, who we don't see too much of, but who kind of arrives in Olympus a couple days into this big week, we really understand who she is. We learn about her relationships with other people. We really get a sense of who she is. So Pride and Prejudice is kind of interesting because I feel like back then, a lot of books were written and there was maybe one or two of the siblings were really well developed and maybe they carried the story. And then the other children were kind of known as the other children. But Pride and Prejudice, even though there are five daughters and certainly Elizabeth Bennet is featured more than the others, you really have a very clear sense of who all five of those girls are. Was that something that you took into your writing process for this book?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's, you know, every book you read is helping you become a better writer, and especially books when you read when you're a bit younger too, I think make even larger impressions on you. And I loved how, I mean, Jane Austen is great in general with dealing with a lot of different characters in her novels. People come in and out, you know, besides just family members. And she's able to evoke each one with specificity, even if they don't have a ton of lines on the page. But I definitely remember the first time reading Pride and Prejudice, and you would, all the sisters have such unique, separate personalities that you would never confuse one with the other. I mean, I think that's a wonderful thing for a writer to see in someone else's work.
So I like to always ask novelists, like, how essential you think it is to read across genres. I mean, obviously, the fiction that you've written is not like a distinct type, but there's certainly things that must influence it. But what about other kinds of reading? Do you like to delve into mysteries or read memoirs or, you know, informative nonfiction? What's kind of your diet of books?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think every writer is different in terms of like what they need for their own work. But I was, you know, a reader long before I was a writer, and I really love variety in my reading. So I love mysteries, especially like noir mysteries is one of my favorite genres. And I've started reading a little more horror lately because it's this interesting thing, like the world feels so stressful and chaotic. There's something even more cathartic about horror to me than it normally would be. Like you somehow feel better reading about the horrible things instead of worse. And I'm reading more and more nonfiction as well. I feel like I love this kind of movement in nonfiction where it's a blend of memoir with kind of more like harder nonfiction topics. So you're getting both a look at the person and a look at another subject matter. Those are really fun. And I'm always looking to read more poetry as well because I feel like nothing makes your sentences better as a fiction writer than reading a lot of poetry.
Are you working on anything new right now?
So I've just started the next novel and it's in very early days, but you know, I was kind of kicking around ideas of like noir mysteries and things you could do with noir to make it feel just a little bit different. And also I've been really engrossed in Texas politics and politics in general the past 5 or 6 years. And so I was hoping to get a little Texas politics in there too, because I'm moving away from the larger than life Greek gods, but if you're looking for kind of larger than life, unbelievable events, then Texas politics gives you that.
So I want to go back to Olympus for a few minutes because we're nearing the end and there's something that I noticed that I wanted to ask you a lot about. So we talk a lot about, and we have in this conversation, about how the town is kind of its own character, you know, the way the town functions, the kind of the history of the town, the people who inhabit it, how this family is kind of at the center of it. But I felt that the Texas scenery in this novel kind of was another character of its own. I mean, the river, the trees, even like the little metal bars of the cattle guard. How did you set about building that world?
You know, it's so interesting. I feel like for a lot of us, the land, if we were raised in kind of a single place for a bulk of our childhood, or even just a formative period of our childhood, and especially if you're raised in a place that's not an urban city, like the landscape just seeps in there. So even though I haven't lived in that part of the kind of coastal eastern Texas since I was 18, that's still the landscape that like speaks to me most when I drive through it, even though it's like really flat, you know, and there's a lot of trees. But like I drive through that, like on my way to Houston from Austin, and I just kind of relax a little bit because it's just so steeped in there. And because I had the good fortune to grow up in the country, our house actually was on the Brazos River. It's not the Briscoe house, and it's my family's definitely not the Briscoes. But where that river is, where those cottonwood trees are, that's the view that I had, you know, from like age 5 to age 18. And I just, it's just kind of in my marrow. So I think it was really, it came out easily because I just put myself back in that place, which is so wonderful, but also so hot. So that makes it less wonderful.
I know there's quite a few like very relevant nods to the Texas heat throughout. Yeah, I'm sitting in a studio in Dallas, so I felt pretty connected to some of those descriptions.
Right. It's just it's been really oppressive here recently, too. So there's nothing like the Houston area humidity to really sap your energy to move.
So something I noticed about the end of this novel is it doesn't, I would never say that it ties things up. There's no bow, but there's kind of this really interesting hint of a promise that there might be some real growth for many of these characters, some real potential for change or movement. What do you hope readers will take away when they read Olympus?
You know, I wasn't sure how the novel would end until I actually got to the ending, just in terms of like what decisions the family members would make and whether they would like be able to mend relationships with each other. But I'm happy that it ends in a place that at least gives some amount of hope. What I was trying to explore, what I realized I was trying to explore, you know, as I was writing, I saw what was in there, is this idea of forgiveness. But I think too often in our culture, we put the work of forgiveness on the people who have been wronged. Like, okay, this person has wronged you. Will you take it upon yourself to do the work to forgive them if we think that forgiveness is a good thing? And so what I wanted to think about in this novel is these people, a lot of them have done really bad things. What is it that you need to do as the person who have done the wrongs to make the other person capable of forgiving you and to kind of shift the burden of the work back on the people that had done the damage to the people around them? And so I wanted people to think about that and also just the possibilities of forgiveness, even when people have done great wrongs. You know, I feel like we're living in a world right now where there's a lot of anger and a lot of difficulty forgiving people. And I want to think that there are ways past that.
Our guest this hour is author Stacy Swan. She's also a contributing editor of American Short Fiction. Her book is called Olympus, Texas, a Novel. Stacy, thank you so much for your time. What a great conversation.
Oh, thank you so much. It was an honor to be on here. It's such a great show.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're also on Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. You can also subscribe to our podcast for free wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for KERA Think. Once again, I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.